Thank you. So I guess after the questions I've asked, you guys can feel free to grill me if you want to. So I'm going to talk about a bioinformatics problem, which I hope you find interesting, but one thing's going for it. It's probably less expensive than the last two talks would have cost. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is isochores, which are not all that well studied, but they're probably the most easy to detect and obvious feature of the human genome. And what they are is these very long stretches of high GC versus high AT content. And I will tell you, and basically they've been interesting for two reasons. One is they just, you look at the genome and they stand out. They're just the most obvious things you can find. And we have no explanation for them, at least up until this point. So they've been sort of this big mystery for the last 30 years. And I'm not going to claim to solve this completely, but I think we have some ideas that are leading towards a solution. Let's put it that way. Oh, and I should also say that this work has been done with Bill Press, who's, as you guys, I don't know if you guys know this, but he moved to, he's moving to Texas. So he's splitting his time between Texas and Los Alamos now. Do you know that, Ari?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's ask the first question. To get everybody situated, we should just talk about what isochores are. So I just took a window of 300,000 bases and in the middle of that window just plot the AT content and slide the window across. So this is just a AT content density. Red means high AT, blue means high GC. So let's look here at human chromosome 11. This is a stretch of, these tickers are 10 million bases. So you can see that here, there's 20 million bases in a row that have a very high GC content. And then right next to them, there's 30 million bases of high AT content. Now, that is, as you can imagine, that's an extraordinary difference. I mean, these can be, first of all, they can be about 20% difference. And, you know, this is a feature that just slaps you in the face. So then in comparison, if we look at fish, there have, if you, these are just different fish chromosomes, you see that they're all high AT. So this was zebrafish. But all fish that we, I mean, granted we've only looked at fugu and zebrafish, but they both have this feature. So it's not dependent. In fact, as I'll tell you a little bit later, any organism more distantly related to us, anything that's not an amniote, does not have isochores. I think I said that horribly backwards, but basically amniotes are the only things that have isochores. So that's an easier way to get at that. Okay. Okay, so you find these things, as I was saying, in amniotes, which is mammals, birds, crocodiles, turtles, etc. Okay, anything else of interest here? And the idea is that...
reptiles split into two groups.
Yeah, so I'll talk about that a little later. But yeah, the reptiles are an interesting case. But they stand out as in, there's something strange about reptiles. And the general idea is that isochores...
The assumption is that all this happens somewhere in the reptilian evolutionary pathway, right? That's why I asked
about it. Yes. Yeah. We will get to that, I promise.
But not correlated to body temperature at all.
Right. So that was a hypothesis for people said, okay, well, maybe this is correlated to body temperature because you get a bunch of these warm-blooded organisms and all of a sudden you start popping up with these huge GC regions. So maybe, and GC, as people know, have a three hydrogen bonds as opposed to two for AT. So maybe it has something to do with stability. But it turns out that leads to a whole set of problems, starting with the fact that there are some cold-blooded organisms that have isochores, but that's just one of the problems. The other set of problems are that there's a symmetry breaking problem, which was the title of my talk here. And the symmetry breaking problem is that you have 20 million GC followed by 30 million AT. It's pretty hard to imagine that there is a differential evolutionary pressure due to temperature on this part of the chromosome versus this part of the chromosome for when they were sitting right next to each other in the same temperature. So
the other ones, even the red ones, there have some fears.
Yeah. So, but the idea would be that something's, you know, these probably got affected to some extent. Whatever's causing these is affecting them to some extent.
Is it conserved?
Is
a red isochore in humans conserved in mice?
You mean does the red map to reds? Yes. And that'll be something we'll talk about later too. Okay, you guys are asking questions that are all ahead of me, but I know. But I have pretty pictures to go along with it, so that'll make it fun. And so one thing that's also been standing out, which is that no one's ever found any, besides lots and lots of effort, no one's ever found correlations in gene function between what's sitting in these blue and red areas here. So we'll get back to that in a minute as well. Okay. All right. And so let's make it a little easier to see, and we'll map the whole chromosome. And what's blue versus red, and why we have sharp transitions. This is just a simple Markov model that gives us the difference between blue and red. Blue being high GC, red being high AT. So there's a few things to notice here, and one I think that's the most obvious and striking is that the end of all these chromosomes are blue, with one exception, and we could talk about that a little bit later. These guys are just missing parts you can't say anything about that. But everything else has blue at the ends. So that's a pretty obvious feature. However, these things seem to be spread out pretty evenly among, sort of randomly, in the middle. And one thing I should mention, people have asked, could this be a telomere effect? I want to remind you that these are, this is something like 30 million bases. So it's not the telomere effect. It's on a different scale. Yeah? Yes.
So it can be, if there's some fusion of chromosomes, for example, there are regions that are distinct.
Yes. So that's a fair point. And this guy here I think it's right here. Is the fusion of the two? So chimp has two extra chromosomes, and it fused. Well, we know that it fused, and it's also sitting in one of these blue areas, and it maps to. And here, this was a break, recent break. If you look at African green monkeys, it was something that broke from since then. But I'll get back to that as well. We compared it to chickens in terms of mapping from one chromosome to another. So let's keep moving. So the next question that we can get to is, so I just told you about scanning windows. What happens if we look at genes? What are genes doing in this picture? Are they just following in the same thing? If you're in a blue region, do you have high GC if you're a gene or high AT? And the answer, there's a couple things. In humans, the genes divide into two groups. This is a, There's one group here which is high GC and one group that is high AT. Okay. Now the way you can really separate these is they also have a different spread in this axis with this G minus C. There's a difference in their G and C content as well, and these guys are much tighter together. But if you go down and look at worm and what? So in this particular case, we were looking at. Do you mean? Oh, yes. We normalized it. Yes, absolutely. But it doesn't matter which strand you... But we took all coding strands, yes, if that's what we want to know. And here, if you go look at what's going on in worm and fly, they all map to these high AT genes, okay? So what looks like happened is that some pressure came along and took some subset of these genes along with these huge regions and pushed them over to high GC content. So that would be sort of the obvious picture, but we need to go back and see if that's what actually makes sense.
This is the 3' UTR you are looking at.
Yes, and I should say that we've done this. I don't want to show you because it's not real exciting to see five of the same things, but if I put up the picture with third codon, you should 5' UTR, intron, upstream, downstream, you would get exactly the same picture. Okay, so this is just a representative. It doesn't really matter, but yeah. All right. So now let's move on and see if we can make these pictures. So first things first, let's just look at, if you just map these things out. I don't know if I need to show this. Okay, it's fun to show because it's a movie, so we'll show it. And basically, if you just, this is just, since you have four variables and a constraint, A, C, G, and T, you can plot it in three dimensions, and it sits, if you just, it just sits in this tetrahedron. And what each point represents is the nucleotide content of one gene, the 3' UTR of one gene. And there's a few things to notice. One is that the direct, this thing looks like a cylinder, as you can see. So now you're looking down the cylinder. And now you're looking lengthwise. It looks like a cigar, okay? And it points to two places, this place right between G and C and the place right between A and T. And what that means is if you're looking on the coding strand only, that on average A equals T and C equals G. And you can also see that in the spread, in because it's a cylinder, this C minus G and A minus T are fairly narrow versus the difference in the other direction, which is the AT content spreads in the long way. Okay? All right. And so to figure out, so we decided to take a look at gene function because, as I said, people have been looking for this for a long time and not been able to find it. So the question is, why not? And so we, for now, we're ignoring that first picture of isochores, which you saw by taking the sliding window, and we're defining GC-rich and AT-rich genes, okay? So, and they're a slightly different picture, and I'll make them go together in a minute. But for now, let's just talk about genes, okay? And basically what we did is we just looked at gene ontology. And gene ontology has this problem, which is that basically anybody in the world can just add some information. You can put a gene in whatever category you want to give information about it. So as you can imagine, there's tons of noise and makes it very, very difficult to use. Fortunately for us, the genes that divide into our two groups divided pretty much evenly into GC and AT content. So we have thousands and thousands of genes to work with. So we have huge sets of data so we can filter out the noise in this calculation. Probably don't need to go through this, but essentially we just these PIs are the probability that according to our model is in gene is in the plus group or the minus group, the high AT or high GC, and we just counted these two numbers for what should be in the high or low, okay? This is for the particular gene, and what we want to know is, let's take a gene geocategory, but instead of looking at the whole category, let's take out a set of words from that category that are linked across all these different words. A typical example could be translation. So there's probably 50 geocategories that have the word translation in them. So we just grouped these. We grouped everything with the word translation in it to see if we can find statistical difference between the two groups based on this word translation. Okay. The math isn't all that interesting, so I'll just. And so, just using these words, we can separate these things into two different groups. Okay. And one thing that you'll notice, it doesn't really matter what these functions are. I'm not trying to convince you that the function of the AT-rich group is one thing versus another. What I want you to notice is that we're getting these huge standard deviations. This is a standard deviation of 9. You know. And this is 5. These are very large standard deviations, and you would never expect any of these by chance in our set, which only had a few hundred in it total. So the point is that we can find pretty obvious functional differences based on these geocategories between these two groups, the AT-rich and the GC-rich groups. No. But that's what I'm going to get to next. But yeah, so then you might ask, okay, I just told you, so we found this. I mean, was this a super special way of finding function in genes and separating them? And the answer is no, that's not what we, but what happened is that there's that opens up some issue that's confounding, right? That I just told you that no one's been able to find differences between the genes sitting in GC versus AT-rich isochores, yet I just showed you that the GC-rich genes and the AT-rich genes are really easy to separate in terms of function. So how do we put this mystery back together? Oh, I guess I should say this quickly. Hold on. So let me add one more. We'll just skip that. Okay. I'll get back to that in 1 second. And the answer is the following, that it turns out that in AT-rich isochores, which would be this huge region here, for instance, as an example, okay, purple is the AT content of 3' UTRs, okay? And green is just done in a different way. But anyways, the point is that this region has only AT-rich genes, and it's an AT-rich isochore, okay? But now let's look at a region. This region has some GC-rich genes and some AT-rich genes. And it turns out that this maps to a GC-rich isochore. So what had happened over evolution is that when this pressure came, everything started AT-rich. Some regions, in a way I haven't told you yet, became GC-rich. However, in that process of becoming GC-rich, some subset of the genes resisted this push and stand out like little AT-rich spikes in this huge background of GC richness. Okay, so AT-rich isochores have only AT-rich genes. GC-rich isochores have a split of AT-rich and GC-rich genes. And it's this split that just... So basically, if you just... And so if you had a... across the entire genome, just randomly distributed genes and their functions, and then just pulled down some set and made that region AT-rich and this region over here AT-rich, etc. You would notice no functional difference between the genes in one category or the other. In other words, spatially separated genes don't imply function. However, since that process of becoming GC-rich, there was selection that kept some set AT-rich in those regions, now we can separate based on AT-richness those selected genes. In other words, the functional difference between the AT-rich and the GC-rich genes are coming from this subset of AT-rich genes which resisted this pull down to GC-rich. There's some functionality sitting here. And so how do we see that? Well, the reason I got started on this in the first place, which is a whole other story, but which had to do with microRNA prediction, it turns out that microRNAs, targets for microRNAs predicted by both us, Bill and I, in another paper, and plus Lewis et al., basically everybody's prediction paper we could find, they're all sitting in these AT-rich genes. Okay? But not only are they sitting in these AT-rich genes, they're primarily in the subset of they're highly, highly overrepresented in that subset of AT-rich genes, which are the ones that resisted their pull to GC richness. In other words, they're the ones sitting in the GC isochores.
So you kind of imply that the evolution is going in one way to increase the GC content. So if you compare mouse with human, do you see GC isochores going up and
where
AT isochores is going down?
No, the isochores are ancient, so they were formed presumably long before mouse and human. Well, in mouse and human,
if you have a whole bunch of species, you can line them together and use outer groups to infer what's the ancestor state. Can you see which way it's going?
Which way isochores are going now? Yeah, so, okay, yeah. So you're asking a different question than I thought you were asking, but okay, let me come back and address that later, because yes, and the common lore, there's been a bunch of papers on this that show that isochores right now are disappearing, and based on exactly what you just described. Okay, So basically, if you use a Markov model and you use two different things for a Markov model, one is the window that I described before, and the other way is you define an AT and a GC isochore state. But now inside this state, you have genes that are You let them emit 50-50 GC and AT genes here and only AT genes here, and you run this Markov model across the genome. It turns out that you get the same answer as if you had used the window counts. Okay, so in other words, these things match up with like a 92%, 93% accuracy. So in other words, we took these two different sets of issues and brought them together, so they do make sense together. Okay, and just a bit of statistics. The AT genes, even though they take up 2/3 of the actual number of nucleotides in the genome, they only count for 1/3 of the genes. 2/3 of the genes are in these GC-rich regions, so they have more dense in terms of gene richness. And almost all the genes in the AT, as I was telling you, in the AT isochores are AT genes, and in the GC isochores there's a split that's about 2/3, 1/3. Okay, but the other thing is that the total number of AT and GC genes are 50-50. Okay, so you might want to ask, do these genes play some kind of special role in the isochores? Since, as I told you, you can define function if you look within the GC-rich isochores, you can find a functional separation between the ones that resisted becoming GC-rich and the ones that became GC-rich. And the answer is yes. And basically, what we did first, if you just move the window across and plot where the genes are, okay, you notice that these blue dots are in these extrema of the GC richness, okay? And same with the red dots. Okay, so then, okay. So the next question is we want to find a correlation between, so how do you answer this question? You want to know, is there something special about the actual location of the gene? Okay, in terms of this background of GC richness. Now, this is a complicated question because you have constraints. The gene itself is coding for something, so you might expect that its nucleotide composition is biased by that. So what we did is, we basically took introns and the intron structure, and we looked at the actual intron in the gene. And then we moved to an intergenic region that was a million bases away from that gene, and we compared the two. And the question is, what's the difference between those two positions? And in particular, we found that we had two different models. One model would be that the genes themselves were sitting in more GC richness than the areas in between, and the other model would be that the genes were less GC rich than the areas in between. And the model we ended up finding was this one here, which is that the genes tend to lead the charge, so to speak. In other words, the genes are more GC-rich than their surrounding, not less GC-rich. Okay, so they are sitting in special spots, and these special spots have higher GC richness. Okay.
Let's skip. That would be predicted from the coding, just having coding region. Gene would be more GC-rich.
Yeah, so we're ignoring, but when we say we're ignoring the coding region itself, and we're looking at the intronic regions around there. Yes, so specifically, so we could rule those out.
In that diagram, there was sort of like this curved thing around the gene. I mean, is that meant the neighboring intron sequence is higher GC when it's very close to the gene, and it's lower?
Yeah. Do you mean here?
Yeah, I mean, is it really curved, or is it...
We know that this point's lower than this point, and we needed to connect them. I mean,
okay,
I just drew it like that.
Okay, but it's not like a smooth trend.
Oh. Could be. that's strictly PowerPoint, making it look nicer. okay, so the next question then is what two questions that when and it's hard to decide between the two. One would be that our first assumption was that if you were changing significant numbers of amino acids in this push, in other words, if we looked at the genes in the GC isochores and we compared them to see what transition. So we lined them up with their fish orthologs, and we looked at what the transitions were in terms of before they were GC rich and what happened in the process of becoming GC rich. And we were under the impression that if you changed a lot of amino acids, that this would mean that this was a massive pressure because you know, to change 20% of the amino acids in some particular way, you would expect to need a huge pressure. But we're slipping on that we're no longer believe that. What we believe now is that 20% of the proteins make absolutely no difference in what are strictly space fillers. We don't think they provide any more function than just space fillers for structural reasons, and which is a really strange result, for, we thought. But I think that other more seasoned biologists sort of have always believed that, or at least that's what David Botstein says. I don't know if he... But he says he, any result you give him, he tells you he knew why that result existed a while ago. But anyways, the idea being that they've done some basic experiments, which is that you can sort of arbitrarily replace some sets of amino acids with another in particular genes and show that on average you're not making too much difference and that the genes function just fine. You have to, it's only a specific set of amino acid changes that make a significant difference.
But would that not show up at the complete
So, in this particular case, you mean?
If you do cross species comparisons with that idea that you can replace many of the without changing anything.
Let's say you want to do the following. You want to compare third codon synonymous versus non-synonymous changes. With the number of generations that we've had, causing a big bias in number of synonymous versus non-synonymous changes really requires a very, very small amount of selection. It can be minuscule, and you can still get huge bias over time. I mean, it would be...
So I'm not sure that I understood. So you said that it doesn't make any difference what is the...
I'm saying that the amount of... So there's two possibilities. So let me describe this slide first, and then we'll get back to that in 1 second. So what this slide is telling you, what this slide is that this is a set of the chemical properties of all the amino acids. And what these red... So what we did is compared fish and human, and what we said is what happens when you line up orthologous genes that are the GC-rich guys in human and their orthologs in fish, and you see what specific changes happened. You don't know the direction, but we know what they are in fish versus human. And for instance, the red lines means that we went from fish to human. And what you notice about these lines is that they're crossing chemical properties. So you're getting huge changes that change massive amounts of chemical properties. So,
direction up is downwards. It's way
closer. Yes. So for instance, here's a chart on the next page where we can actually see specifics, which is that if you look at prolines in humans, right, and look at what they align to in fish, and we realize that the things they align to most that weren't prolines, obviously, 20% didn't align to prolines, they aligned to something else. And the four most common guys that they did align to were serine, leucine, alanine. And the point is that you can always see that the transition was going from something that was AT-rich to a change to a CG-rich change. So it was in this case always a T to a C or a G to a C, okay? Or A to a C, I guess. So anyways, it covered the whole spectrum. In other words, it was just a pressure where you took the, you know, AT-rich genes in fish and turned them into CG, you made a CG change and it became a proline, okay? But that happened in 20% of the amino acids. And if you look at the other way, you look at what, you know, what misaligned so that there's many more of them in fish than in human, you get the opposite change. So in other words, it looked like it just changed to something else. It's the same. It's always the AT in fish to CG in human, and every single amino acid is explained. Its bias is always explained perfectly by this. Okay, so it's not literally every single one. Okay, so now we can get back to your question, which is that. So what we're claiming here is that there were two possibilities. One is that this change, whatever the evolutionary pressure was to cause this CG richness, was so strong that even though you get this functional deficit by changing to proline, 20% of the gene, 20% of the 20% of these various guys, you still end up that was the evolutionary balance. You were balancing two pressures, and that was the strength. But what we've come to realize is that it's much more likely that this was a somewhat neutral pressure, and that these things, and that these amino acids didn't really change the weren't so detrimental to the function over time that we needed a huge evolutionary push. So it's not that there was no selection, but it wasn't that.
Are you saying the protein products of all these orthologous genes are the same function? They didn't change the function after all these changes?
Oh, I mean, I'm sure that there's some changes, but it, but
you said neutral, so that implies no change.
Neutral, so evolutionarily neutral doesn't mean no change. Evolutionarily neutral means survival rates change. So the point is that you didn't cause such drastic, drastic selection to it wasn't like you were balancing two pressures where one was so enormous and the other one you were able to make enormous changes in the other direction. That's what I'm trying to say.
In general, the protein are always the same in fish and human beings. There is a 50 or 60% difference typically in amino acid identity.
Yes.
Between the two species. And both of these changes were known to be neutral or semi-neutral ahead of time. So what you're saying is that embedded within this neutral drift is a selected trend that we don't understand.
So what I'm saying is this. I'm saying that there's been lots and lots of changes between fish and human, and most of them can be described by conservation of chemical properties. We're saying that we can show a selective force that had nothing to do, that crossed these chemical boundaries just completely, and replaced one amino acid in fish and human. It's not explained by having similar chemistry and therefore having a minimal change on the. What we're claiming is that the minimal change is that these weren't doing anything.
Can I compare synonymous and non-synonymous in changing conditions?
Sure.
Whether there's a difference between neutral as
a
synonymous and something that could have been selected?
Yeah, and sure, you get a higher rate for the synonymous than non-synonymous, but it's not. But the point is that it's not. You get hugely high rates for non-synonymous, much higher than expected.
Can one actually compare chromosomal position of those orthologous genes between human and fish?
Between human and you can, but between human and fish, you get a big mess. I will do it later with human and chicken, which is what I'm trying to get to.
So mess means that the position is randomized.
Very, very highly.
You clearly have clustering of these GC genes.
Yes.
Genes that became GC.
Yes.
They have to cluster.
Yeah.
But the statement is that in the fish, they were distributed more or less uniformly on that chromosome?
No. I mean, they're still clustered to some extent. It's just the mapping would just be hideous. It would be hard to see, but they still cluster, yeah.
But they're still clustered.
But not clustered in the 20, 30 million bases range. They cluster. They're significantly clustered, yes.
They're significantly clustered in.
Yes. They haven't been diced that much, but yeah, they have.
So now if you add the mouse data, do you see there are more changes or less changes to CG? If you go from fish, if you see fish, mouse, and human, you can actually see the loads of infer some kind of consensus in the human mouse. Can you see
so I'm going to do something similar, but we didn't use. Could we hold off on that question? Because I'll get to it. But we used chicken instead of mouse for a reason that I'll get to in a minute. Yeah?
Did you try that just focus on the fourfold synonym sites and take the third codon position
and then count transitions between AMT and CMC, and do you get a bias there in that region, which is sort of you could estimate the selective force acting on this CG?
You'd have to put in a model as well, because you really come out to the point where you're.
But that's counting.
You're making them. What?
You could just count the
transition. Yeah, but the point is that you're not going to get a transition rate easily out of that, because you're getting to the point where you're, for some genes, where you're really turning every single gene, every single position CG rich. So once you do that, you're asymptoting. But it's definitely higher than the rate for amino acids. Yep.
You're saying that the GC genes are sort of leading the charge in the GC isoforms.
Yeah.
Now the AT genes that are in the GC isoforms, are they just being overruled by being a minority?
The AC genes in the...
In the CG isoforms.
Our view is that these are the guys who have a functional reason to remain AT rich. For instance, these are the guys who are microRNA targets. Now, what our hypothesis is, in another paper, we can show correlation, not causation, but it's true that something like 85% of microRNA targets, at least predicted microRNA targets, are very AT rich. So the idea is that. It's a strong possibility that AT richness is actually needed to be a microRNA target. We don't understand anything about what causes a microRNA target at this point.
So, do you know, these AT genes that are resisting the promotion in the AGC isoform,
uh-huh.
Do they have larger? So they're going to try and create a little mini AT isoform, right? Inside the big GC
isoforms. Yeah, it's just on a different scale. Genes are, I mean, we're, you know, on a 300,000 base window, these genes show up as a blip.
Okay.
You know, they might be 20,000-30,000 bases, so they're a blip on this. These isochores are huge. They're 20 million bases. A particular gene you don't even see if you smooth out.
Okay.
They literally look like spikes.
I was just curious, because it looked like on the chart you get in the beginning that the number of AT genes that were in the GC isoform wasn't much less than how many GC genes that were in the GC isoform. Or is that...
There's 2/3 of the genes in the GC isoform are GC and 1/3 are AT.
Okay.
Okay, so let's move on to a comparison between chickens and humans, which actually turned out to be one of the most fruitful things we did, because, well, we'll get to that in a minute, but this allowed us to answer, at least give a hypothesis for why there's this symmetry breaking issue, which is, I think, the most confounding question in this whole theory. And so first thing to notice is that you get these two populations of genes in chickens as well. They have isochores too. Okay. So now let's take a quick look at the chicken chromosome. Okay. Now the chicken have all these sets of mini chromosomes down here. Okay. And we'll get to that in 1 second. And one thing you notice: remember, a GC gene is blue, and an AT gene is red. So the first thing you notice is that these things are all blue. All these little guys down here. Okay. But let's be aware for a second, and there's a catch here, which is that what I plotted wasn't the chicken genes. I plotted the map from the human genes. So in other words, all human genes that are GC rich are mapping in very high levels to these little chromosomes in chicken, which are all GC rich. Okay, so now we're starting to get an answer of how symmetry breaking could have occurred. It had to do with dicing up there's some dicing up of the chromosome issue that's causing the symmetry breaking. Okay, and we'll get back to that in a second. So the other thing that we're supposed to see here, I should put it back here. The height, height is the fraction AT. Okay, and the color is what isochore type we define this to be in. Okay, so in other words, how is this? Right. So remember, like here, this will be a GC-rich isochore because it's all blue. as I said, but this is a mix of AT and GC-rich genes. This right here, these genes are all both AT-rich and high, so that's an AT isochore. Okay? Okay. So now let's take a quick look at what happens if you change the height to chicken. Okay? I should put some animation in this to make this. I'm going to do the remedial animation here. Okay, so let's take a specific Let's take a specific example, and let me find a good one that should be representative. And okay, so here now in this case, the height is going to be chicken. Okay. Let's just go. That's going to be impossible. In my head, it seemed like a brilliant idea, but it just doesn't come out in a way you can see it. So here, I'll just plot them next to each other, and then you'll be able to see it better. Okay. So anyways, so there's a bunch of things that I want to point out. One is that as all the human genes, all the human GC isochores, or at least a large percentage of them, map to these small mini chromosomes. Okay. So the question is, where do the other ones come from? Okay. And one thing that we notice is that if we look in, let's take as an example chromosome 8, okay? So here, if you look at the end of a chromosome, okay, chromosome 8, you see that you have, these are the human orthologs. The human orthologs are both AT-rich, and they're in an AT-rich isochore, okay? But now let's go look over here. They're red because these are red. It's just the same coloring. But now their height is what's their AT richness in chicken. And you notice that they're spread out all over the place. So now they look like a GC-rich isochore. So in other words, being on the end of a chromosome makes you look like you're a GC-rich isochore. Makes you become a GC-rich isochore is what we're saying. Okay. So the idea is that. Being near the end of a chromosome is where the pressure was to become a GC-rich isochore. Now these little guys are all GC-rich isochores because by definition they're all near the end of the chromosomes. And if you map them out from where, you know, through these, people have all sorts of different models for how you reconstruct ancestral chromosomes, but these things all look like they're on the ends of chromosomes in some ancestor, and they broke off and became these little guys, okay? It hasn't been done in a way that I would feel comfortable putting up here. It's something that I've been thinking about a little bit, but it's, you know, people have done it, but it's a mess. I mean, I think if we worked hard, we could get it. I'm going to say I don't know. It's never been done in a way that I was satisfied with, so I don't know if it can be done, but potentially. And in principle, this could actually help us, I think.
Have some chromosomes a long time ago before the mammals
split. Yes.
And then they started to become red the ends.
Uh-huh.
And then they recombine, you know, they have some rearrangement in
yes.
the chromosomes, and then they were becoming blue again, the rearrangement, there was another one, and become blue again. And after all this shuffling, what we see now is these bands of blue and
yes. Cutting off ends and regluing them. So what's thought to be true, independent of us, is that the actual ancestral chromosomes looked a lot more like the human than like the chicken. That these little guys here were. That we had more big chromosomes and there haven't been that much reshuffling, and that these were just break off. Something happened weird that broke these things off the ends of other chromosomes.
In the human chromosome, you really have these two regions in the middle.
Some of them. So there's been some reshuffling, but you notice that it's not. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. What's confusing about that?
I'm just wondering if I can.
So the issue that makes this hard is we don't know when isochore formation stopped.
Well, you know, in bacteria, right, the horizontal transfer, one observes somewhat similar phenomena. So there's a chunk of DNA comes in GC organism gets stuck somewhere, and you can therefore easily identify.
Yes.
And then people have estimated the acceleration rate of how rapidly it is relaxing to AT content of recipient organism, right?
Right.
So I'm just wondering if you can estimate, based on this data, the two things. How often you transplant the end of a chromosome in the middle, and how rapidly it then anneals to whatever local AT.
I think both of those are perfectly reasonable to do if we can convincingly get... So what happened is that we started AT, went GC, and now we're relaxing back to AT. If we can figure out what this point is that we, time-wise, when we started, when the isochores stopped forming, I think it's reasonable to do.
Where do these blue chunks...
But I haven't thought about it too much.
Where do these blue chunks have to fish, you know? Do also, you also map them into small pieces or...
Oh.
They seem mapping to fish, you know, what do you see?
You mean where do they map to fish?
Yeah, you just take this human isochores. Where do you show that if you map to chicken, you see these sniffer chromosomes. Where do they map to in the human, in fish, you know?
We didn't see anything interesting in the pattern, but I can try to find the picture at some point. We didn't see anything interesting in it, but we do have that picture. But it's...
The logical conclusion of this mapping is the conclusion of your thing. I think what I'm looking for, and please explain to me why this works the way what I want, which is completely impossible with you. I would like to see a reconstruction of what the chromosome map looked like for the common ancestor. The best guess reconstruction of what the chromosome map for the common ancestor of crocodile, chicken, human look like. And
yeah.
Then do a mapping of those three taxa to see whether or not the GC regions fall on the ends of that ancestral chromosome.
I agree. I agree that would nail it, and we have been thinking about this, and we're going to try to do that. So far, people have done it. I mean, this is, someone asked something similar, and people have done it, and their answers are, the way they did it made huge assumptions, and they don't make any sense. I mean, we don't believe their results, so we haven't even tried with what's out there. So we'd have to do it ourselves, and we're thinking about doing it.
Have you done the reverse? Because if you know that the mini chromosomes is highly derived, then that the human is at least closer to the ancestral structure, then it seems like the mapping the other way around would be the more appropriate.
And the mapping the other way around gives this also the interesting result. I mean, it gives the same thing. You can show that the chromosome, basically you can show that the chromosome ends in human, map to AT-rich middles of a lot of them map to AT-rich middles of chicken. In other words, regions that it looks like what happens, the places where you think that chicken might have broken off, then the GC richness came about. In other words, there's no inconsistency. In either mapping, it's not to say that we know for sure this is what happened, because as you were saying, we need to reconstruct the ancestral chromosomes, but there's no inconsistencies in this picture, as far as we could find, which is that ends, if you're an end in one, and what you don't expect is to be an end in one and be GC rich or whatever, and map to the middle in another and still be GC rich. Okay? So that doesn't happen. That would be contradicting what we said.
I was wondering, is there no biological reason why maybe ends of chromosomes on BCG roots?
Yeah, so the reason that isocores, this is a good question, I should have brought this up a while ago. So the sort of leading theory on what actually causes isocores in terms of biochemistry is something called biased gene conversion. And what that means is that if you have a chromosome break, okay, you have a chromosome break and then you have your repair mechanism come over, and the bias is that the repair mechanism tends to repair when it gets mismatches between A's, AT's and GC's, it tends to repair them with, so let's just go over quickly again how this works. You have two, so if you have a double-stranded break, the way you template how to repair this break is with the homologous chromosome, okay? But the homologous chromosome doesn't have exactly the same nucleotide at each position. It has some variations. And those variations can be, you know, one could be A and one could be G, okay? And so the point is that when it uses the template to repair this the double-stranded break, the idea is that there's a bias towards replacing, picking, when you have to pick one or the other, AT versus GC, that it preferentially picks the GCs, okay? Now, this has been actually shown to be true. There is such a thing as biased gene conversion. And basically the idea, the way this remains steady at about the normal genome, you can have a steady state at about 50% AT and GC, is that you have a matching, you have a bias in the overall mutation rate, single point mutation rate, from GC to AT, and then the double-stranded conversion bias rate brings you back to GC. But the idea being that chromosome ends break more. That's the answer. Chromosome ends break more, so if biased gene conversion is the answer, you're throwing off the bias by having more breaks.
In bacteria, the longer the genome, the more GC
reach. Huh,
I didn't know that. I just read something ago. It was actually shown in a paper in which a very small genome had 160 kb.
Huh.
I can't find the reference, but is that something that you have addressed by the isocore
community? It is not. So if we look at here's a comparison. Where am I going here? I'm skipping ahead just to answer this question. I'll go back to which is I think the picture someone was asking me for. These are the guys that have isocores. So you're talking about things that would evolutionarily meet, you know, in like eight towns that way. What? Yeah, there are people that do, but it's, you know, they're not. There's a lot. The same people who work on GC content in general work on isocores, but they would. So I think guys like Phil Green and so forth would be working on the bacteria as well.
So they think when they have this breaking of the chromosome, they don't have this bias.
Huh? The fish when they.
When they break chromosomes.
Yeah. They do not. So presumably they don't have this double-stranded pair bias. But, you know, that hasn't been proven. I mean, I would say biased gene conversion is a theory with literally zero evidence at this point to show that it causes isocores. I mean, but it's the leading theory by the people who are the most respected working on this, so. Oh, it's like 2 minutes. That's what you want. Is that what you want to know? Am I almost done? Yeah, maybe 5 minutes at most. Okay. So, right. So now I'm comparing human to chicken. Okay. And so we can really see what I was talking about a minute ago, which is that. Let's look here. Now we're on. So as you can see, these are back to the human chromosome, and the bottom ones are the human chromosomes. And if you're on a human chromosome end, you don't necessarily, these are the guys aren't mapping to GC rich.
These are the same thing?
Yeah.
So what's on top, the bottom are real chromosomes in human?
Sorry, this isn't a syntony map, this is a map of orthologs.
It's the same.
I wouldn't claim, what I don't want to be claiming, and maybe you didn't mean this, so I wouldn't be claiming it, but I'm not claiming that the ancestral chromosome look like human. Sorry.
What's saying that? basically, the one is an intact human chromosome.
Yes.
The top is just
the mapping of.
It's mapping.
Yes. That is true.
Maybe it's a little far away, but it would typically be a single layer.
Yes.
So it could be made of many chromosomes of chicken.
Yes.
Okay.
And so, for instance, you'll notice that the only places where you're getting places that are blue in human, which are, and red in chicken, are places where they're on a chromosome end. So in other words, these are places where the ancestral chromosome broke, presumably, right? And you see that all over the place. Sometimes it matches up, but then if you look at these internal ones, some of them are a bit fuzzy, but the internal ones are actually matching up from in both species. I know it doesn't look perfect, but it's as close as we could get in our syntony map. Meaning that these are places in the humans, right, that these aren't on chromosome end, so they must have formed long before, according to our theory, must have formed long before long ago. Not, they're not forming. These are forming since this chromosome broke off. So these must have formed long ago, and they match up with where the in principle these come from. If you map these out, these are those mini chromosomes in chicken. Okay. The point being that the ones that are internal to humans are explained by being ancient chromosome, ancient isochores, and the ones that are external are new. Okay. Which is the idea behind forming chromosomes, forming isochores now.
Just looking at it, I'm not at all sure that it's statistically significant. There are lots of regions with color changes and that are not at the end.
Right, so...
So you're saying, in mind, you have another story to explain though.
So they would have been at the end at some point in time in the common ancestor.
Right, like right here, right? Yes, these were in some common ancestor, these were at the ends of whatever that common ancestor were. But now it's... So that's why they're both blue.
But you're not trying to say that there is a sort of a significant correlation between changing color and being at the end on the basis of the data.
Oh, there...
You are saying that.
Yes, there, and I am saying that, and yes, I'm not going to put the statistics on here, but it's hugely significant.
You still leave it open wide, the ends are blue.
The ends are, so the hypothesis is the ends are blue because the chromosomes break more at the ends, and this biased gene conversion is causing...
So biased gene conversion occurs more.
Yes, that's the hypothesis. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have to explain everything, but a correlation is pretty large, actually.
It wouldn't be good if you don't come up with some statistical measure.
Well, we did. I mean...
And the statement is that you did, and...
And it's more... Yeah, but I mean, I always find that okay, you know, being statistically significant and being the cause of something are not necessarily the same things.
No,
but yes.
It's a logical question, right?
It's a logical question, and we've...
If it's not statistically significant, it doesn't mean that it's not true. It's just that you have to look somewhere else, or you have to look some more. You know,
right, right, right.
I'm trying to understand whether you're saying that you've proven it, or...
Right. So the statistical, so it is statistically significant, and it, in other words, having an area where there is a long blue stretch in the human one and no blue in the chicken is very rare on this picture, except at chromosome ends, is what I'm saying. And like you don't have I know it doesn't look perfect here, but you have these huge regions of GC rich, and it matches some GC rich up here. I mean, you have some difference in what your Markov model is going to give a different answer to some extent. But
I don't see it by eye, but if you've done the analysis, I'll take your word.
Okay. I was hoping someone would see it by eye, but... yes. Absolutely, and we're looking at mouse right now, to be honest. I've looked at it a little bit, but I'm doing more... Right, so mouse is...
Do you say that there is a complete change to blue ends at completely different places in the synthetic genome of the mouse.
So I don't know yet exactly what I don't feel comfortable making a statement about mouse yet. But
you expect it?
I'm not sure when the mouse genome got diced up, but so it was at least obviously 100 million years ago, but I'm not sure how much prior to it was in the last 100 million years. So no, I don't expect that. I expect that very little has happened on the mouse chromosome ends, because I think that isochores haven't been forming for whatever reason in the last 100 million years.
So what's special about
humans? They just didn't get diced up. The chromosomes are more stable. Mouse is an exception, I think. I think most organisms had, you know, matched pretty well with humans, and there was very little. I think in the last 100 million years, I don't think it's thought that humans had too much reshuffling in their chromosome structure, whereas mouse, for some reason we don't know, got diced up completely. Not that I know of, but I can't say that I've done a thorough search. But it's not, I've never seen it reported that there are, no.
Why are there little chromosomes so much?
So presumably what happened with the little chromosomes is they were chunks that just broke off of ends of some ancestral chromosome. So we had ancestral chromosome with mouse, and during this process. So let's go to the evolutionary slide.
That generally was the case if you look at the synteny between ends and chicken has lots of little chromosomes.
Yes.
And I guess you know the genes on those chromosomes.
Yeah.
And they come from the ends of big chromosomes.
I mean, I can't say I can prove that because I don't know how to reconstruct the synteny between, but I think that's what's believed to be true. But I mean, that's not from me. I mean, I've read that that's true, but I can't prove it.
So I'm trying to see which direction this GC richness is going. Like you mentioned before that if you look at GC isochore and you look at GC genes, their GC content is like highest point, like even inside isochore. So that seems to suggest that there's relaxation going on and there's resistance to relaxation.
Yes.
In genes.
That seems to be exactly what's going on, yeah. Oh, I have no idea. I just copied this from a... I don't know what half of these things are. This is just... I think this is... I don't know if you guys have gone to that Tree of Life site. I just I clipped it out and put it on here.
This must be platypus.
What does that taste compared to?
What? Platypus? Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right, maybe. We got to guess that it's platypus. But I don't know. Oh, sorry. Sorry, not platypus. It's some kind of bird. Is it chicken and some kind of bird? I don't know what it is. I wouldn't have known that turtles were Chelonians either. Anyways, I should. Okay, so I'm pretty much done. But just a little bit on our theory of what's going on here, right? So one possibility, amphibians don't have isochores, and anything farther related to us than this don't have isochores either. So the only thing that have isochores that we've found are sitting in here. The only problem is that there seems to be a problem, which is that snakes and lizards don't have isochores. And if we said that anything from here on out had isochores except for snakes and lizards, that's a weird statement. So there's two possibilities. One is that is it something started here which then began making isochores from here on out, and for some reason something stopped it in the lizards and snakes branch, or that there was a separate starting point where it started here and here separately.
No, but there's a contradiction with the chicken and human alignment.
Okay, so there's no... So I didn't show this data, but if you line up the chickens and humans, even though... And this is weird. You line up chicken and human genes, orthologs, and the same genes are GC-rich in humans and in chicken, but the actual changes... There's no correlation. They're not correlated at all.
Okay,
So in other words, there was a pressure to, the same genes had whatever this pressure is to become GC rich, but they did it completely separately. So it's not true that they changed the GC rich before they split. Maybe that wasn't the question you asked, but it's a point I should have made earlier, so I'll use it as the answer to your question.
Does that suggest that they wanted to become GC rich and didn't care what the changes were?
Yes, exactly.
But they wanted to become GC rich.
Exactly. Which
the property being selected was a GC rich and not the base pair.
Right. So which would it be explained, which is perfectly consistent with a neutral pressure, which would be something like neutral in the sense of not being selection on the gene function. Right, which would be this biased gene conversion, for instance.
Selected towards a property we don't understand, which is called GC richness.
Right. But it's not selection in the sense that we're not claiming that it's selection in the sense that something became GC rich and therefore survived at a higher rate. We're claiming that the rate at which the mutation rate effectively was biased in those regions by this biased gene conversion.
Wait, what does it mean so that survival was stronger? We just don't know.
That's a whole other possibility, and there's been 30 years of papers on possible reasons why this is not neutral, and there's selection, and you know, this comment that someone asked about warm-bloodedness, they have all these claims on why warm-bloodedness explains this and all this, but I think the leading theory right now is that it was not related to natural selection. No, it doesn't have any. Yeah, that's why no one believes that it had to do with warm-bloodedness, right? As soon as you start seeing this in cold-blooded organisms, you don't believe that it's warm had to do with warm-bloodedness.
Sorry, I'm still confused by the direction where this goes. Why the alternative hypothesis is that you start with isocode very anciently and then just get equilibrium in some of these branches like amphibians? Why is that not modeling that correct?
How do I know that it didn't start here and then here it just...
Right, did you just equilibrate in some species, right? And you see this is certainly happening also in mouse.
But
mouse is less extreme than human genome.
It's less what?
It's less extreme when you look at the isocode distribution. Also, another argument
I mean, you know, we could argue that, but that would be... What you can't do is in an evolutionary argument, you can always say, how do you know that something didn't happen and then reverse itself before we got to see it? There's no way to test that. It's true. It could very well be that these things here had isochores and then unformed and don't have isochores now, but our, you know, the sort of Occam's razor is that they never had isochores. What?
Only need to disappear in one of these branches.
Well, they...
Because you say yes, and just this branch, amphibians, no.
Right, but there's been a few papers written that show that isochores are now not only are going away at this point. So whatever the process was to cause isochores over some presumably long period of time, it disappeared in all these branches. Okay, so it was only a temporary thing in all these branches.
So it's going away because you don't have any organism.
So I can tell you how I know it's going away, but I don't know. I don't remember exactly what. There was a big paper written that said it was going away, and I decided to check it separately. And the way you do that is you line up human with chimp and monkey, okay? And then we basically use monkey as an outgroup. And the question was, what direction are the mutations going now? And we looked in the GC regions, and the mutations are reversing. The GC rich regions are biased towards AT rich. It says it's going away in humans.
Yeah.
And if we reverse it, we can show it's going away in chimps.
In order to know it's going away, it had to have reached a peak at some time in the past, and now it's changing, right? And you don't know the past sequence. That's the point I'm making. You can do the present sequence.
No, but so you can do the past by, I mean, so let's say we have monkey, chimp, and human. Okay, so let's just use right. So we say that this position here was an A, and this position here was an A, and this position here was a T. Your argument is that this the common ancestor was an A. Okay. Now this isn't perfect, but it should work enough percentage of the time that over the huge amount of data that we have that we'll get the right trend. And the trend that we got was make that a C. With trend we got is that in the GC rich regions, the G's and C's are disappearing, and the AT. So as long as you have an outgroup, in principle, on a large enough scale, you can define the ancestor. We broke the symmetry. We broke the symmetry with the outgroup. Yeah. Okay. So
your model for function had something to deal with gene conversion, but that's true for all the animals. So why would the yes guys have isochores to do something with gene conversion, and the no guys not require isochores? They still do gene conversion.
So. Right, so this is a biochemistry question, and the hypothesis that people have been putting forth are that something biased this gene conversion, that everybody does gene conversion, but that in amniotes in this time frame there was a 100 million year period where there was a bias in the gene conversion. I have some problems with this theory, to be honest.
Does this happen in amphibians or other invertebrates?
I don't think anybody would have.
The conversion model cannot explain the decrease, the going away of the isochores.
Well, it gets explained by saying the bias. No, it doesn't. There's lots of problems with this theory, and it's not my theory, and I don't mean to be. I don't want to defend it too seriously, because I'm not claiming that I'm providing evidence of it. I'm just saying that it doesn't seem to be inherently inconsistent with anything I'm doing. You mean that these do have isochores and they're small or something? We missed them?
Yeah, because the branch is no branch. Just picking before.
Oh, this came out here? If I put that on a slide, anybody who is an evolutionary person would want to kill me. But I assure you that was our thought, and then it was a non-starter for anybody who knows what they're talking about in this field. So I'm going to give them some credence to say that you know. I don't know that for sure, but. But I think people are fairly well convinced that that's where that line comes in.
What was wrong with the theory that he gave again, that the simple solution is that everybody had isochores and they just went out faster than amphibians and lizards and snakes?
That is the theory. That's my theory. That I think it's makes much more. You mean everybody starting here?
The first vertebrate had an
isochore. Oh, way that way?
Yeah.
And the A's were the changes, not the GC.
And that they disappeared everywhere except for.
No, not everywhere. You only need the two branch disappearance just in that two branch, then it's okay. Just two last events.
Okay, fishes are not here, so.
But I mean, this is like, if I put the tree of life, this is about 30 clicks from where we started to get to this.
The world of life going back to the first eukaryote.
It's possible but I mean, I think the normal hypothesis would be if you find a property that's only in this group, that it's not something that disappeared in every other branch of life except for our group. I mean, it's just.
Easy to disappear,
but it's disappearing.
What?
It's disappearing in that group, though. So it just disappeared faster than all the other groups. But you know it's disappearing.
If you wait long enough, one of these guys, one of the yeses will be a no.
For example, the turtles, they live very long, so it's about from one generation to another generation. They do it very slowly. Humans are the same thing, and fish, they very fast.
Okay, so I was just going to summarize. Let me just go to the point. I think I've got, you know, some idea of what we think's going on. But I can give an idea of what we. This is my last slide, by the way.
I understand, but. You did say something that was very functional and correct, and that is that only the AT-rich genes were regulated by microRNAs. That's a functional property, right? Everything else was this sort of random gene conversion that was, you know, a biased gene conversion stuff, and it's drifting neutral and everything, and then you come back and say, hey, but there's a function here, if that's correct, only the AT-rich genes.
So the function that we could find is that within the GC-rich isocores, the genes that resisted this conversion to GC-richness, seem those we can find function in. In other words, they resisted for functional. We claim that they resisted for functional reasons because we can find function, different functionality in those genes. So
once you assign function, you could talk about collection, and that is there are threaded genes that don't have to be regulated by microRNA.
Right.
And they drifted, right? The other guys resisted it, right?
Yes. But I mean, I don't think there's that many micro. I mean, people would argue this, especially if
because
Nicholas was here. But
we know what 300 and some microRNA and they got the same number of targets. You're talking about the targets, right?
Right. So the prediction. So it depends on who predicts. But being as sort of the low level of prediction is that you know microRNAs might have on average. On the low end of target prediction, 10 targets or something. On the high end, every gene in the genome is regulated by microRNA. But let's stick with the 10 for now.
But then what is known? You can't raise up this if someone can add that.
Well, known, but I think that what a biologist considers to be known and what a biologist considers to be known and what a computational biologist considers to be known aren't necessarily the same things. I mean, I can show something where I can write a model where I can show statistically that some percentage of what I did is correct at some level, and no biologist in the world is going to believe me. But it doesn't mean that I wouldn't consider that to be true.
I just want you to finish your last slide.
Oh, sorry. So what we don't really know is what we've just been talking about. Is it biased gene conversion? It could be back to the someone was mentioning the selection could be that you need stronger chromosome ends for some reason, and we don't know why it turned on or off, or did it? Could be some oscillatory thing. Could have been happening forever. I don't know. And okay, so I'll just end there. Say goodbye.